Okay, we are going to now make a segue. Entirely. Now we're dealing with an issue where people are excessively upset about something that's not very serious. Okay? And if you look at your handouts under the outrage management tab, the very first page is called Reducing Outrage: Six Principal Strategies. That's the first page. There are a whole bunch of other pages, but I'm not going to make it through the first page. I'm going to talk about a few of these six strategies. If I had a whole day, I could get through all six of these strategies. If I had a couple of days, I could get beyond these strategies. But these six strategies are the keys to the kingdom in outrage management. They are very different from anything we've talked about with regard to precaution advocacy. We're making now completely the opposite assumption. And the first of the six strategies is to stake out the middle rather than the extreme. In any controversy between the claim that X is incredibly dangerous and the claim that X is perfectly safe, incredibly dangerous always wins. But in a fight between incredibly dangerous and moderately dangerous stands a very good chance of. Now, in that sense, risk communication simply isn't the level playing field. A neutral strategic advisor, which is what I am, I'll work for any side. A neutral strategic advisor brought in by an activist group and asked, how can we increase the outrage? Advise us on how to get people more outraged about this risk. Would advise, among other things, exaggerate. The more you exaggerate how dangerous this is, more outraged people will get. There are limits. You can't exaggerate too much or you'll have a credibility problem. But precaution advocacy is compatible with considerable exaggeration. The same consultant brought in by industry and asked, how can we reduce the outrage? Or if people aren't already outraged, but we're worried that they're going to get outraged, how can we prevent outrage? Would advise, don't exaggerate. If you exaggerate how safe this is, the exaggeration will backfire and the outrage will go up instead of down. Now, I realize you guys are neither activists nor industry, but you are both, depending on which hat you're wearing. When you're doing precaution advocacy, you're wearing an activist hat. And when you're doing outrage management, you're wearing an industry hat. So you're sort of the swing vote. You can go in either direction.
Peter and I have a little bit of a difference in terms of using the word exaggerate to describe what you should do when you want to increase outrage. And I think exaggerate just has too much implication of misleading or overstating. So I like to say dramatize, make the truth as vivid as you can. Give people vivid emotional pictures of it rather than just facts. So when he says exaggerate, I say dramatize. But depending how you define the words, it's still just to make it really real for people so they can imagine themselves in the scary or dangerous situation.
I mean, for reasons of ethics, I'm not prepared to advise you to go beyond drama into actually misstating the facts in order to arouse more outrage. But I'm not here as your ethical advisor. I'm here as a communication expert. And I have to tell you, the likelihood of people getting mad at you for warning them in too exaggerated a way is slim the likelihood of people getting mad at you for reassuring them in too exaggerated a way is very high. I mean, think about Greenpeace. Greenpeace has been exaggerating, not just dramatizing, but exaggerating for decades. And it has not eaten into their popularity. And I want to emphasize, it's not because people don't know they exaggerate. It's because people don't mind. Okay? The standards are not symmetrical. If you go to the general public and you say, do activists exaggerate? They'll say yes. And if you say, is that a problem? They'll say no, that's their job. And then you ask them, does industry exaggerate? They'll say yes. And you say, is that a problem? They'll say, damn right, they should throw those bastards in jail. That asymmetry really irritates my industrial clients, but it's not foolish, it's just conservativeness. Okay, remember I introduced the concept of conservativeness at the beginning of the day. If a smoke alarm goes off and there's no fire, that's a minor problem. If there's a fire and the smoke alarm doesn't go off, that's a major problem. So we calibrate smoke alarms to go off too much so that they won't miss a fire. Does everybody agree that that's smart? Given that we can't get the smoke alarm just right, we want to err on the alarming side with our smoke alarm. Okay? We similarly calibrate activists to go off too much, okay, as part of their job so that they won't miss a risk. And we calibrate health departments to go off too much. Okay? And health department, when health departments literally, exaggerate, then, I'll buy that it's not, it's not terrific ethics. But it doesn't cost you the way it costs you when you exaggerate when you're in the reassuring role. When you're in the reassuring role, if you're 98% right and you ignore the 2%, talking about the vaccine, you're 98% right, the vaccine opponents, the people who are worried about the vaccine, are 2% right, and you make 98% sound like 100%, that enables them to make 2% sound like 80%. And it does you a world of harm. When you're trying to alarm people, exaggeration, maybe it should, in an ideal universe, maybe you should get screwed there too, but you don't. Yes?
Except that yesterday the smoke alarm went off and virtually nobody was in the alarm. What about that?
It's because the stamp didn't move.
It's a good point. We have been desensitized. Okay. We need new smoke alarms. You're right. Exaggeration does have, exaggerated alarm or, unnecessary alarm, you do get something that is called in the literature warning fatigue. People get tired of being warned and having the warning not work, not be needed. Warning fatigue exists, but it's surprisingly mild. Hurricane forecasters can say there's going to be a hurricane, evacuate, and you evacuate, the hurricane goes somewhere else, you go back. And you're much more glad you didn't get hit than angry at the forecaster. And next week when they say there's another one coming, you evacuate again. A few people don't. A few people say, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. But most people, particularly if the hurricane forecaster knows something about risk communication, and for example focuses on saying if the hurricane keeps going in the direction it's going, it will hit here, and we don't want to take the chance, evacuate. We may be wrong, we sure hope we're wrong, but it would be awful to take the chance. So, a hurricane forecaster that does it right gets very little warning fatigue, even if they are dramatic about the warning. Warning fatigue is real, and I think you're right. We have it for hotel smoke alarms. We don't have it for the smoke alarm in our own house. We still take that one seriously. Other comments? I do want to go on, but yes.
But I think even with hurricanes, we saw Katrina. Katrina had other things like socioeconomic status, people didn't have the resources and the means to leave. But there are a lot of people who had the ability to leave but chose not to because those warnings were sounding so off, and they became complacent to those warnings. And I'm in the Northeast, and we also get hurricane warnings, and we just shut them off. And Northeast sister is the same thing. We don't, you know, everybody says you should have a supply of things, and we believe that.
I hear you, and you're both comments are saying that warning fatigue in some areas of the country and some kinds of risks is a bigger deal than I'm implying. And I hear you loud and clear. I will still stick to the generalization that when you exaggerate an alarm, you're going to get some warning fatigue. But by and large, you know, you and your alarm will do okay. When you exaggerate a reassurance, you're going to get a huge boomerang effect of outrage.
Isn't a good example of that is the national terrorism threat level?
Yes. I think that is an example. The main thing to get here is it's non-symmetrical. And when you're doing outrage management, you really have to bend over backwards to stake out the middle. A well-fought fight is a fight between one extreme and the middle. The side that's trying to increase outrage exaggerates, and I hear you both that, you know, you don't want to exaggerate too much, but the side that's trying to increase the outrage, you know, can afford to be more dramatic and more exaggerated. The side that is trying to reduce the outrage stakes out the middle. It's a fight of between an extreme and the middle. If they can seduce you to the opposite extreme, they win. If you can seduce them into the middle, you win. And if neither of you is seducible and they stay at the edge where they belong and you stay in the middle where you belong, then it's a fair fight, and we can't tell you anything. What does that mean in practice? What does staking out the middle mean in practice? What it means is you figure out what the other side's good arguments are, and you include them in your own communication. That's counterintuitive. That's not what we normally want to do. It's normally what we want to do when the other side, you know, if people are attacking you. And when people are attacking you, some of what they've got to say is valid. Some of what they've got to say is exaggerated. And some of what they've got to say is crap. We all agree? If you're normal, when it's your turn to speak, which of those three do you respond to?
Crap.
Crap. Okay. The normal response, when it's finally your turn, is to say, that's crap. Okay. You rebut the crap. You ignore the valid grievances. You ignore the germ of truth in the exaggerated grievances. And you rebut the crap. When you do crap rebuttal, whose outrage are you managing?
Your own.
Okay. And if you're going to manage your stakeholders' outrage instead of your own outrage, then you do the profoundly difficult thing of ignoring the crap. And spending much more time validating the valid grievances, acknowledging the ways in which your critics are right, even though they are more wrong than right. Now, I'm not saying validate the crap. And sometimes people get the impression that I'm saying validate the crap. And if it's crap, it's crap. If it's wrong, it's wrong. Don't validate grievances that are mistaken. Don't validate claims that are mistaken. But don't use precious face time with critics to rebut crap either. You know, you rebut the crap somewhere else. You know, every organization, every health department should have a crap rebuttal corner of its website. It's not usually called crap rebuttal, it's usually called frequently asked questions. But that's where you can say, you know, people often think X, but the evidence shows Y. It's important for a variety of reasons to do crap rebuttal, but not when you're in contact with hostile stakeholders. And not when you're in contact with their surrounding stakeholders. Surrounding the donkeys who are hostile are a whole bunch of people on the seesaw. Okay? And they are going to be more responsive if you acknowledge the valid grievances than if you focus on rebutting the crap. You see what I'm saying when I say that if both sides are doing, you know, optimum strategy, they will rebut your crap and you will validate their valid grievances. You know, when you're on the outrage management side and they're on the precaution advocacy side, when you're on the precaution advocacy side, then you can play it What you need to do is figure out what their valid arguments are and include them in your own communications. That's hard to do. It's hard to do for psychological reasons. It's hard to do for intellectual reasons. Sometimes it's hard to know what the other side's valid arguments are. It's hard to do for organizational reasons. You know, your organization is not going to be pleased with you. It's worse, of course, if you blindside them, but even if you don't blindside them, you can have a meeting. You know, there's going to be a radio talk show tomorrow, and we agree that you're going to go to that talk show, and you're going to validate the other side's valid arguments. You're going to, and the other side's spokesperson is going to be there. We'll call her Susan. That was my first wife's name. I like using it for the other side. Susan is going to be there, and you're going to say, yeah, Susan's right about this, and yeah, we did screw that up, and yeah, that is a problem. You're going to validate Susan's valid arguments. You're not going to validate her crap, but you're not going to focus on rebutting her crap either. You're going to validate her valid arguments. And I am arguing that vis-a-vis two of your audiences, vis-a-vis the people who are already highly outraged, and vis-a-vis the people who are on the seesaw, vis-a-vis the seesaw audience and the donkey audience, that's the right thing to do. Vis-a-vis the follow the leader audience, that's the wrong thing to do. Okay, so you have to decide which audience is listening to the talk show and which audience you care about most. But you're gonna validate her, Susan's crap. I'm gonna boost Susan's valid arguments. Okay? And you go and you do it. What happens when you get back to the office?
Yeah.
If you still have an office. I mean, people feel betrayed. You wash the agency's dirty linen in public. Even people who were at the meeting where we decided you were going to do it, I didn't know you were going to sound so sincere when you did it. So it has an organizational cost, and I don't want anybody to get fired just for doing good outrage management. Doing good precaution advocacy is worth getting fired for. Doing good if you're killing people, then you have to blow the whistle so that you save lives, that's worth getting fired for. If your organization doesn't want you to do good precaution advocacy, do it anyway. If your organization doesn't want you to do good outrage management, don't. But I want you to know what good outrage management is, so that when you're in charge or when no one's looking, you can do it. Okay, that's enough on number one. Number two is to acknowledge your prior misbehavior. Now, by prior misbehavior, I don't chiefly mean illegal things you've done that nobody knows you've done, and when they find out, you will go to jail. If you've got any of those, I urge you to seek legal counsel, not risk communication counsel. Okay? But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about things that are already on the public, in the public domain. Maybe the public knows about them. Maybe the public used to know about them but has forgotten. Maybe the public never knew. Okay? But they are public. They're already out there. Anyone who does their due diligence, anybody who does a Google search, is going to find out. So what we're talking about. We're not talking about secrets. We're talking about stuff that is public. And the question we're asking is, if you've already made it public, and it's not on your side, it reflects badly on your organization, or it reflects badly on your cause, should you dwell on it, or should you mention it once to get it on the record, and then leave it alone? Now, having made the point that I'm not talking about secrecy, let me talk about secrecy for a minute. The rule of thumb for secrecy is that secrets do approximately 20 times as much harm when someone else blows the whistle on you as when you blow the whistle on yourself. That's only a rule of thumb, but it's useful because you can do math with it. Given that 20x factor, what it means is that secrecy is cost-effective if and only if you can successfully keep secrets at least 95% of the time. Everyone follow that? If you successfully keep your secrets 98% of the time, then one time in 50, the secret comes out, it does 20 times as much harm, and you're still ahead. If, on the other hand, you successfully keep secrets 90% of the time, one time in 10 it comes out, it does 20 times as much harm, and you'd be better off revealing all your secrets. Now, I don't know what your agency's secrecy success rate is. I tend to think no organization in the developed world can manage 95% or better anymore. In the developing world, you can, because you get to disappear your critics. That's a big advantage. but you guys can't disappear the vaccination opponents as much as you might want to. So the likelihood that things like Simpson Wood will happen is very high. If you don't know about Simpson Wood, look it up. It was a set of secrets that that got out in about vaccination. My bottom line judgment is that you are unwise to keep secrets, but it's not insane to keep secrets. Maybe I'm wrong. Here I am saying I don't think you can manage 95%, and you may be thinking, God, if you only knew what we have in the filing cabinet, we're doing better than 99%. I wouldn't know. I get called when the secret is out, to help my client get their foot out of their mouth. And I don't know about the successful secrets because they haven't raised a lot of communication problems yet. So I'm not the best judge. The point is, although I think secrecy is unwise, I think it's not a good gamble, it's not insane. Here's what's insane. What's insane is to reveal the secret and then act as if it were still secret. What's insane is to have it in a technical report and not on your website. What's insane is to put it in Appendix 17 and not in the executive summary. That has all the disadvantages of secrecy combined with all the disadvantages of candor. If you're going to keep it secret, keep it secret. If you're not going to keep it secret, wallow in it. Okay? Talk about it endlessly. The middle branch, where you mention it once and never talk about it again, is insane. Now, it's insane in outrage management. In a low outrage environment, that's not only not insane, it is the normal strategy. If you take a PR course, PR is, of course, designed for low outrage environments. If you take a PR course, they will tell you what to do with bad news. What does PR say about bad news? They say, okay, admit it once because secrecy is dangerous. Admit it once, preferably on a slow news day. Admit it on Friday because nobody reads Saturday's paper. And then, if you're ever asked about it again, change the subject. And there's a term in PR for changing the subject. What is it called? Spin. But there's another narrower term. Bridging. Maybe you've heard of bridging. Any of you?
Yes.
Okay, you've heard about bridging. Have you stopped beating your wife? I'm glad you asked about my wife. Let me tell you about the wonderful health education program she's working on. And you have bridged from wife beating to some other aspect of life that is something you want to talk about. And in a low outrage environment, the conventional advice, and it's very good advice of PR, is admit the secret once, never mention it again, and if asked about it, bridge. And that absolutely makes sense in a world in which nobody's paying much attention. In a world in which you have enemies who are paying extreme attention, that's insane. Because if you mention it once, they're going to get it. If it's discoverable, either legally discoverable or discoverable with this very rare research tool called Google, they're going to find it. And if you only mention it once and they can find it on Google and you never mention it again, you are giving them the control over when to harass you with it, when to accuse you of it, and you're giving them the opportunity not only to accuse you of doing it, but to accuse you of trying to keep it secret. And then you say, well, I mentioned it once, and then you know how much good that's going to do. Is everybody following this? In outrage management, there is no middle branch. Either you keep the secret secret, knowing that if they find out it'll do 20 times as much harm, or you reveal the secret and wallow in it until everybody is sick of it. Not until you're sick of it. Until you're sick of it instantly. Until they're sick of it. until the postal workers say, I'm tired of hearing you apologize, Dr. Gerberding, can we move on? And when they're sick of it, then you can move on. But you wallow in it. There is no middle ground in which you admit once that you made a big mistake about the weaponized anthrax spores. There's no middle ground where you admit that once and then don't talk about it anymore. Now, I want to prove that to you very quickly, and then we'll move on. You are married, and you have had an affair, and you regret your affair. You love your spouse. You want to hold on to your marriage. You end your affair. And now you have risk communication options. You can keep your affair secret. There's a high probability that you will never get caught. If you get caught, you will be in worse trouble than if you admitted your affair. You may not get caught. Or you can wallow in contrition for your affair. You can admit it and talk about it a lot. Do we all agree that bridging is not an option? Talking about your misdeeds or your misbehaviors or your mistakes in a high outrage environment is like talking to your spouse about your affair. You either don't do it at all or you do it a lot. You don't do it once. Now, that used to be all I would say about number two, and then I had a client who called me up, and they said, well, we did what you told us. We wallowed in our misbehavior, and it doesn't seem to be working. They're still really angry, and they don't seem to be getting sick of it, like you promised. So I went back, and what I discovered is that they were wallowing in their misbehavior, but they were wallowing in it proudly. I had forgotten to tell them that when you wallow in your misbehavior, we have to be able to tell that you know it's misbehavior. And that got me interested in the dynamics of forgiveness. So let me take a few minutes to talk about forgiveness. Are there any Roman Catholics in the room? Oh, good. The last Catholics count. The experts on apology and forgiveness in Western society are the Catholic Church. That doesn't mean that they're any better than anybody else at apologizing, but they really know how to forgive. This is an ecumenical experience. You're now going to hear about Catholic dogma from a New York Jew. And step one in getting forgiven, step one is to admit you did it. Now, already politicians are in trouble. They don't want to admit they did it. Politicians love hypothetical apologies. Whatever it is I might have done that might have offended people, I'm sorry. And we all know how well that works, which is to say not at all, any more than it does in the confessional. You go into the confessional and you say, Father, I don't know what my sins are, but I sure as hell repent. And what does the priest say? Get out of here. Come back when you have a list. Catholics, am I right? You got to have a list. If you don't know what your sins are, you're not ready to begin the process of repentance. Okay? And similarly, in the secular process, you have to know what you did and admit that you did it. Then comes step one and a half. This is one and a half because it's the only step that's not in the Catholic process, and that is to shut up while we yell at you. Okay? God does not require that. God lets you skip directly from admitting you did it to saying you're sorry. But in the secular process, between admitting you did it and saying you're sorry is a very important step in which your stakeholders tell you what a jerk you are. Okay. And you can't skip that step. It's what public meetings are for. Okay. It's what venting is all about. It is useful time getting yelled at. Okay. Now, obviously, nobody likes getting yelled at. Men especially don't like getting yelled at. So, step one and a half is a major issue in the dynamic between men and women in many marriages. Where men like to say to the women in their lives, I did it and I'm sorry. And now you can't yell at me because I already said I'm sorry. Women now, you know, it's premature apology is one of many kinds of prematureness problems we men have. How does it work?
We need to discuss this.
We need to discuss this, actually. Yeah. Don't want to hear your apology until I'm done telling you what a jerk you are. Then you can say you're sorry. Okay? And saying you're sorry has some subcomponents. Part of being sorry is regret. The word regret is unusable, and the lawyers have ruined it. You know, the company regrets to announce doesn't sound regretful. But I wish it hadn't happened. If only we'd done things differently. If, you know, regret is essential to an apology. A second part of saying you're sorry is sympathy. You're sorry for somebody, and you know who you're sorry for, and you know it's like, I'm sorry it happened to you. And third, key part of saying you're sorry is responsibility. If your child throws a ball in the living room and knocks over a lamp, and your child says to you, Mommy, I'm sorry your lamp broke. What's wrong with that apology? It's got regret and sympathy in it. What's wrong with it? Yeah. What does the kid have to say? I'm sorry I broke your lamp. So there has to be responsibility. Now, if I had more time, I would talk at great length about how you express responsibility without opening up the floodgates of liability. It is doable. The classic example, and I'm going to give you the punchline without giving you the story that goes with the punchline, that I had a client that expressed responsibility without expressing liability with the following sentence: our lawyers tell us it's not our fault. But we feel like it's our fault. And we're going to act like it's our fault. And the first sentence of that apology protected them from liability, and the second and third sentences expressed responsibility. And, you know, without knowing the story, you can use those two lines. And there are a variety of ways of doing that, but you know, some way of expressing responsibility, even if you're not able or willing to take on the legal liability, is essential to an effective apology. Step three, after you have said you're sorry, is to make it right. And that has two components. Part of making it right is to compensate your victims, and part of making it right is to improve. That is, you have to make a case that you have learned something, and you have to make a case that you are going to make whole, or at least move in the direction of making whole, the people who were damaged as a result of your error or your misbehavior, your agency's error or misbehavior. Now, the most important thing to say about number three is that it is number three. And order matters. You can't say you're sorry until you've been yelled at. You can't make it right until you've said you're sorry. You know, and until you've said you're sorry enough. How do outraged stakeholders respond to organizations that improve or compensate, especially compensate, that compensate without an apology? What gets said if you compensate your victims without saying you're sorry? Yeah, you're right, but say it louder.
You're paying me off.
Yeah, you're paying me off. It's a bribe. How dare you? You know, my children's health is not for sale. How dare you try to bribe me? Now, if you have said you're sorry enough, then they want the bribe. But they don't want the bribe independent of the apology. I have a lot of clients, government as well as corporate, that are not willing to admit that they did it. They're not willing to shut up and get yelled at. They're not willing to say they're sorry, but they're willing to make it right. And they will endlessly say to me, look, if I make it right, isn't that enough? You know, and the answer is no. Making it right does absolutely no good in outrage terms. Obviously, it does good in hazard terms. It does no good in outrage terms unless it is preceded by the other steps. This is like, you know, the order matters, and you can't skip any steps. There was a hand. Yes.
Kind of example of that, exactly what you're saying right now, Virginia Tech is the families are compensated, but they're still outraged that the university is taking responsibility.
Yes. Yep, families have been compensated. They're still outraged that the university isn't taking responsibility. And that, you know, I've heard sentences like that my entire career. And it just makes sense. It is how you feel. You know, if you go back, you know, you buy something and it doesn't work and you bring it back and you raise hell and the sales clerk, you know, is arrogant and unapologetic and throws a replacement at you. He's made it right. What's happening to your outrage? You know, up, not down. You want the apology more than you want the compensation and improvement. Normally, outraged people want to be vindicated more than they want to be compensated. After they're vindicated, then they want to be compensated. Yes?
How does this work if you know of an issue that your company should apologize for and you want to do the right thing and get it out before you're responding to it? So how do you give people an opportunity to yell at you when you're doing like a press announcement or something? Or do the journalists
Yeah, well, then you kind of collapse it a little bit. I mean, you start by admitting you did it and saying you're sorry and that you plan to compensate, and then you stop and you wait to get yelled at. And you wait for the next news cycle in which, you know, it's all going to be, you know, your victim saying, you know, you're awful. And then, you let that play out for a while, and then you come back and say you're sorry some more now that you've been yelled at. And then they yell some more, and you come back and say you're sorry some more. You don't turn the spotlight on your compensation and improvement until they're not yelling so much. So they smoosh together more than I'm implying, but they're still... What's the last stage, Catholics? What's the last stage of contrition? last stage of a successful apology? You must do a... Penance. The difference between penance and compensation is about your victims and penance is about you. That's why penances are not supposed to be useful. The priest does not tell you to go work in a soup kitchen. That's compensation. The priest tells you to do Hail Marys, and that focuses you on your sinfulness, which is its purpose. And in the secular process, similarly, there must be symbolic behaviors that constant, that are analog to the Hail Marys, analog to the kind of penalty that the priest imposes on a penitent, where you are documenting and dramatizing your awareness of your mistake. And you cannot complete the forgiveness process without some kind of penance. By the way, very often fines are a penance. And health departments, you guys are more on the giving end than the receiving end of fines, but you should help the people you find, the organizations you find, understand that. Let's look. A company is going to get fined by the health department. It's going to be fined, $50,000 by the health department. And let's look at three different risk communication behaviors the company can do with regard to its fine. Okay. Option one, don't tell anybody you've got fined. Option two, issue a news release in which you say, all right, technically we were in violation and they threw the book at us and fined us $50,000. And, they're right technically, so we're going to pay the fine. But it's all bullshit. It was a trivial paperwork violation. I don't know. We don't understand why they got so upset about it. Nobody got hurt. No harm, no foul. No big deal. But it's just not worth the hassle to protest, and we're just going to pay and forget it. Option three. You put out a news release in which you say, this is incredibly humiliating. We thought this kind of violation would never happen. And thank God the health department found it, and thank God they found it early before anybody got hurt, because this could have been dangerous. This could have caused serious disease. The fine is entirely justified, even though nobody got hurt. Moreover, we are aghast that this could happen, and we are rethinking our health precautions, rethinking our safety systems, looking very carefully at other aspects of our operations to see if there are other problems that we missed, just as we missed this one. We are taking this extremely seriously, and we just can't tell you how embarrassed and humiliated we are to have this major mistake discovered. Which of those three is most common? I'm sorry, it's least common. Three. which gets the penitential value out of the fine. If you want to be forgiven, it's a sunk cost. You're gonna pay the damn fine anyhow. The cost of being penitent rather than unpenitent is zero. You know, the fine is the fine. It's not a higher fine if you say you're sorry than if you say, you know, it was bullshit. I have go to a lot of effort with clients, getting them to finish the apology process with the penance. And, you know, sunk costs are the best of all possible penances because they're free. Any questions about the process of saying you're sorry, which is central, remember, to number two, which is acknowledging your prior misbehavior. Any questions about any of that? Yes? It is a real problem. I mean, it's also a hazard problem. It's, you know, given that you don't understand, I mean, you know you've changed your vaccination manufacturing process since 76 in a variety of ways. But since you don't know what caused the Guillain-Barré outcome, you don't know if the things you changed necessarily took care of the problem. So it's a hazard problem as well as an outbreak problem. That's a meaningful qualifier as to whether this new swine flu vaccine might also have comparable problems to 76. If you assume it won't, or you assume it probably won't, then I think, I prefer the second to the first, then I think you are in a position to say much more than you have said about GBS and 76, that, you know, to validate, this is both number one and number two, validate people's concerns. Of course people are worried about the swine flu vaccine. The last swine flu vaccine was in 1976, and the vaccine turned out much more dangerous than the flu. The flu never happened, the pandemic never happened, and the vaccine had 1 in 10,000 cases of Guillain-Barré, a creeping paralysis. So of course people are upset. And here's what's different. And then you start talking about, you know, two major differences. One major difference is this time we know the pandemic is happening. Gerald Ford jumped the gun a little bit, and you know, we had not jumped the gun. We were behind, not ahead. The pandemic started in April, and here we are rolling out vaccine in late October. That's one difference. And the other difference is vaccine manufacturing has improved in a whole lot of ways, and vaccine safety testing has improved in a whole lot of ways. So you have something to say. The strategic question is, should you be proactively talking about 76 or not? And the answer depends on what environment you think you're in. If you're talking to people where outrage is high, you should. If you're talking to people where outrage is low, where the problem is ignorance rather than outrage, why would you mention GBS? I want to make sure the most fundamental thing of the day is you have to decide where you are on the map before you decide what strategies will work. If you are doing outrage management, it is foolish not to mention Guillain-Barré. If you are doing precaution advocacy, it is foolish to mention Guillain-Barré. Okay? If you are doing both at the same time, you're in a pickle. And you have to decide which one you're doing right now and what the distribution of the audiences is and which audience matters more to you, and you have to make a judgment call. But I want you to understand the pure cases. And yeah, you should certainly be responding to the valid Guillain-Barré concern of people when you're talking to people who are outraged or who are listening to people who are outraged. We're on a seesaw with regard to the vaccine safety. Does that help?
Yeah.
Other comments on number two? I want to, I'm going to take an opportunity to make, to do a quick radiation example, and then I'll go on to number three. The statute of limitations never ends on outrage. In 1993, U.S. Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary had, apologized for secret radiation experiments carried out on citizens during the Cold War. She was apologizing. Remember, some of you remember this? She was apologizing for radiation experiments done 20 years before. When she was in grade school. And I'll quote from her: "We were shrouded and clouded in an atmosphere of secrecy. And I would go, I would take it a step further. I would call it repression. I was appalled and shocked to learn of the tests, and it just gave me an ache in my gut and my heart." Similarly, there have been apologies for slavery in recent years that are, more than 100 years later, and that are nonetheless meaningful. So, it's never too late to apologize. Okay, any questions about number two?